Hi, Tony Hines here, and you're listening to the Chain Reaction podcast, all about supply chain advantage. Well, great to be here. You're listening to the news roundup, all things impacting global supply chains this week. Well, the UBS chief executive, Sergio Ermotti, said on Friday that painful decisions about jobs would have to be taken after the Credit Suisse takeover, and he hoped these would be finalized in the next few days. He said we won't be able to create short-term job opportunities for everybody. Synergies is part of the story. Well, I suppose that's what everybody's takeover is about, trying to get synergies. But this was a forced takeover, if you remember. UBS was asked to take over the reins because Credit Suisse was in such difficulties. And Switzerland's number one bank agreed to take over in March, its smaller Swiss rival, as part of the rescue deal by the Swiss authorities. And he stressed it wasn't a merger, it was a takeover. And they've already said that they overpaid. I reported that last week in the Saturday News Roundup. And so here we are again, talking about a way forward for UBS with Credit Suisse. So people aren't going to come out of this unscathed. They're just slowly going to drain away jobs, I would imagine. Be better if it could be done swiftly so that it could be sorted out quickly and people could move on. Well, Stellantis is in the news again this week. You remember last week? We were talking about the arrangement with Tesla to use their charging points and get access to those in 2024 so that they could get some security when they sell their EVs to consumers in the US. They want to be sure that they've got fast access charging points. And the only way to do that probably quickly is to use those that are already there. Well, this week it's in the news again, Stellantis, but for a very different reason. And this week, Stellantis and General Motors paid a total of $363 million in civil penalties for failing to meet US fuel economy requirements for prior model years. The record-setting penalties include $235.5 million for Stellantis for 2018 and 2019 model years, and $128.2 million for GM covering 2016 and 17. That's according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which administers the Corporate Average Fuel Economy Program, CAFE. It's a nice name, isn't it? CAFE, CAFE. But got a sting in the tail, obviously. Well, this week, India's Tata Group signed an outline deal on Friday to build a lithium-ion cell factory. It's an investment worth around 130 billion rupees. That's 1.58 billion US dollars. And it's part of the nation's effort to create its own electric vehicle supply chain. Compared to the population size, India's car market is actually quite small. Tata Motors dominates EV sales, which made up just 1% of India's total car sales of about 3.8 million last year. So this is an agreement between Tata's Agratas Energy Storage Solutions and the government of Western State of Gujarat. Said the plant is to be based in Sanand, northern Gujarat, and it's due to open in under 3 years from now. It will initially have a capacity to manufacture 20 gigawatt hours, and that could double in a second phase of expansion. So it's a starting point to develop the EV ecosystem in Gujarat and, of course, in India. Well, you've probably been wondering when the big news story of the week would come up. And this is the big news story of the week. The crisis of the US debt crisis has been averted. And of course, Joe Biden, Senator McCarthy, and of course the House voted the deal through, and everybody's quite relieved. But we didn't really think it wasn't going to happen, did we? It would be pure stupidity not to go ahead and approve the government's debt amount, wouldn't it? I think so. So there we are. Storm in a teacup or never-ending saga? Will this one go on and on? Will we be there again in 2 years' time? Who knows? The Senate passed the deal late on Thursday, and so now the ceiling is set at $31.4 trillion, which meant avoiding the first ever default, which would have been absolute chaos. The Senate voted 63-36 to approve the bill that had been passed on Wednesday by the House of Representatives, and lawmakers raced against the clock following months of bickering between the Democrats and the Republicans to get things done. The Treasury had warned it would be unable to pay all the bills on June 5th if Congress failed to act. So Senator Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said on Thursday that he'd steer the legislation through and we're avoiding a default tonight. Joe Biden praised Congress for their timely action. It's a big win for the economy and the American people, he said. So I guess everybody's mighty relieved with this one, and that means that they can carry on the business of governing and carry on the business of financing everything that they have to finance. In the end, the Republicans said that they'd won a $1.5 trillion reduction over 10 years, which may or may not be fully realized. Well, of course it won't be, will it? Because it will get more expensive to run the state. I think we already know that that's doomed. The opening bid was for $4.8 trillion. It's just illogical, really, because everybody knows with inflation and with time, the bills will get higher. And who knows what's going to happen by then? So, it's like the Mad Hatter's Tea Party. Who got crumbs on the watch and stopped time? Who's murdering time? And will the principles of the universe be turned upside down? Well, I'm guessing so. If they stick to that $1.5 trillion over 10 years. Ridiculouser and ridiculouser. It's very easy to take more than nothing. Is this a language game? Or is it a numbers game? We need Ludwig Wittgenstein and we need Charles Dodgson. They could sort this one out. Well, it looks like Linda Yaccarano's got a big job on at Twitter. This week, the head of trust and safety at Twitter, Ella Irwin, resigned from the social media company, which has faced criticisms for tax protections of harmful content since Elon Musk acquired the company in October last year. Irwin joined Twitter back in June 22 and was head of trust and safety after the previous head, Yoel Roth, resigned. Her job was to oversee content moderation. Irwin's departure comes as the platform is struggling to retain advertisers, and brands are wary of appearing next to unsuitable content. Well, can understand it. They want to protect the brand and their reputation. It's quite strange, really, because you'd think they'd want to protect the brand in a particular way, wouldn't you? And probably the only way to do that, it's important to maintain the integrity of Twitter. And that will attract more advertisers, probably. So we'll have to see how that one works out. Well, regulators around the globe are scrabbling, trying to draw up rules about how generative artificial intelligence ought to be controlled. ChatGPT and the like. It can create text and images, and people are getting quite hot under the collar about it. But this week, Japan's privacy watchdog said on Friday that OpenAI, the Microsoft-backed startup behind ChatGPT and the chatbots, oughtn't to collect sensitive data without people's permission. And that's going to be a nightmare, isn't it? Because if you're a machine learning algorithm, you need the data to actually learn and process and learn. And of course, if they're stopped from accessing the data, then the learning can't take place. And if you think about the European regulations on privacy and privacy regulations elsewhere in the world, then it's going to be a real issue. And it's one that's going to play out over the next few months. But of course, a lot of data is already being collected as people are using ChatGPT. And so, will the regulators be able to stay ahead of the game? I suppose that's the question. Japan's been on the back foot for some time with this kind of technology, and it's playing a bit of catch-up at the moment, trying to stay in the game with regard to generative AI. Japan is the third largest source of traffic to OpenAI's website, according to the analytics firm SimilarWeb. And of course, the G7 leaders are going to be discussing this topic in the coming days. The Italian regulator, Garante, has had ChatGPT taken offline before the company agreed to install age verification features and let Europeans block the information that they give from being sent and used by the system, by the machine, to train the system. OpenAI's CEO, Sam Altman, met the Japanese Prime Minister, Fumio Kishida, in April, ahead of the G7 Leaders Summit, where Kishida had led a discussion on regulating AI. Altman said this week that he had no plans to leave Europe, after earlier suggesting that the startup might do so if EU regulators gave them a hard time. So I wonder where this one will all end up. You can see it's going to be like treacle. Well, back to the Mad Hatter's Tea Party again, aren't we? I seem to be going there a lot this week. An interesting story caught my eye this week, and it's about Amazon's plans to allow Prime subscribers to have mobile telephony free. Yep, that's right, free. Free to Prime. Be a big incentive, wouldn't it, if they did that? Well, we wait and see how that develops. It's just a story at the moment. But it's something they're serious about, of course, because they're already in negotiations and talks with several telecoms companies on how to do this and achieve their goal. But it'd be a good deal, wouldn't it, if you just paid $10 a month and you have free telephone calls and you get all the services of Prime? That'd be a knockout blow, wouldn't it, to lots of other providers. Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun said on Friday that it's taking an awful long time, frustratingly slow is the way he put it, to fix supply chain problems. Even though the demand for planes has bounced back to pre-pandemic levels, Boeing's seen improvements in certain areas of the supply chain, such as the engine, forging, and casting, according to Calhoun. But the ability of the aircraft company and European rival Airbus to meet the customer demand for new planes will still be constrained 5 years from now, he says. So why is that, then? Well, he goes on to say they've got to be smart about how they manage the supply chain against these demand spikes. Yeah, it's volatility, really, rather than just demand, because, of course, demand for planes fell dramatically during the COVID period, and sometime later, we've got demand back to normal, which is seen as a spike, of course. That's about cranking the system up again, getting it working properly. Visibility is the big problem in supply chains when it comes to managing volatility, of course, because you're going to have eyes on. You have to know what's going on in that supply chain. Boeing say they regularly track 25 to 30 parts from a subset of supplies, which have previously been troubled. But the surprises still come about from time to time. If a defect happens, it might mean you can't make next month's schedule. You can't do the delivery. That stops the income, slows down production, cause blockages, get back up in the supply chain. All sorts of things can happen. So defects could be a big issue, and especially in the aircraft industry. We don't want aircraft with defects, do we? None of us want to fly planes that have defects. Calhoun said it's probably cost them 25 airplanes in the air, but he says it's manageable, and they'll be ramping up production to 38 jets by the end of the year. Last month, he said it could take until the end of 2024 to iron out the supply chain problems, the various constraints. And that's simply the same with Airbus. The chief executive, Guillaume Faure, has said that production would rebound pre-pandemic levels at the end of 24, or even 25. So he's hedging his bets, isn't he? 24 or 25. Big difference, isn't it? So what's going to happen with all these backlogs in the supply chain? Well, unfortunately, you can't see them getting sorted out in double quick time, can you? Because there's too many pieces of the jigsaw to put right. So it's, again, this story, watch this space. Well, the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States is proving to be a good solution for the British Electric van startup Arrival. They have bases in Detroit and Bicester in England, and they've had a number of problems in their quest to become the next Tesla. They want to be a big player in this space, and a second reverse merger will give the company a fresh start. It was founded in 2015, and it's developed vehicles for high-profile customers like United Parcel Services and Uber Technologies. But in building this EV of the future, they've burned through a lot of cash, and they've never scaled up. The problem is scaling up. And I reported on Arrival probably now about 18 months, 2 years ago, on the podcast, and you can still go back and listen to the episode. And they were doing some really good things in the EV space. They've got $283 million from a merger with a special purpose acquisition company, SPAC, Kensington Capital Acquisition Corp, announced in April. Executives at Arrival said they'll focus on just one US-produced vehicle for now, and that's a Class 4 or medium-duty delivery van that will bring a $40,000 Inflation Reduction Act subsidy, which is far above the $7,500 for smaller electric vans. Investors are very on board with the idea. They're excited. And I think they've picked the right type and right size of vehicle for the market. So it all bodes well. I hope it goes really well for them, because they have worked hard to get the company to this position and probably deserve a degree of success. The tax credits through the Inflation Reduction Act will most certainly help. Arrivals made three prototypes of smaller vans, which they call the L van, at Bicester in the United Kingdom, and they're being road tested for development. Class 4 vans are more appealing to many than the smaller vans because the price and the margins are so much higher, and it's probably what the customers want as well. I mean, you have to stay focused on the market. I mean, I know tax credits and so on can influence decisions, but you have to stay focused on what the customer wants. And I think that's probably right. It's probably what they do want are those Class 4 vehicles. The question's going to be, will they have enough cash to keep the production cycles going? And that's always the question with the investment, isn't it? Are you going to generate sufficient cash to keep the wheels turning round? Forgive the pun. Arrival lost $2.3 billion in 21-22, and they've said that they hope to have revenues of $14 billion by 2024. And the SPAC deal will go a long way to help that. Arrival has cut staff almost 75%, down to 750 employees. And according to sources, it had $130 million in cash at the end of the first quarter. And you have to put this against what it costs to push out a new vehicle. When you launch a new single model of a vehicle, it can cost in the region of $1 billion US dollars. So the investment sums are quite small by comparison. Medium-duty electric vans targeted to start from around $175,000 US dollars, and the segment's said to be worth about $5 billion, so they're really focusing on that segment of the market. No doubt we'll return to the story in the future. I hope with good news. Now, I was reading a story earlier in the week, and it was about the downturn in the purchase of EVs. Apparently, there's been quite a drop in the numbers of people prepared to buy them presently. I think it said about 15% fall in the article I read. And I thought that was a bit telling, really, because the big problem, I think, for the EV market presently, and I think it's one where Tesla and Elon Musk have got right, they've put the investment into the charging points and they've made them fast charging points. But I think most other EV manufacturers, where they're playing catch-up, they haven't really thought about the infrastructure as much as they should have done before they launched headlong into producing vehicles for sale. And I think that's going to be a crunch issue if they don't sort it out. And people will rethink their plans. Yes, they want to do right by the planet. They want to be sustainable. They want to go green. But the infrastructure, if it's not there, will prevent that from happening. And the other story that caught my eye this week, there was a story in the Independent newspaper in the UK, which talked about taxation arrangements for EV cars. Now, how true this story is and how confirmed it is at present, I'm not sure, but I thought it was an interesting approach. It said that the government had been warned that they could lose £10 billion in tax revenue as people switch over in the next 10 years to electric vehicles. Because currently, if you purchase an EV in the UK, you don't pay any road tax. So I'm guessing at some stage, the government's going to turn around and say, well, we've got to tax EVs because we need the money. Apparently, they get a large chunk of taxation from road tax, even though we have lots of potholes on our roads here in the UK and lots of repairs that need doing that don't get done, which really kind of hacks off a lot of people who are paying road tax. And I think, as we move forward, they were talking about charging something like 6 pence per mile. That's the rumour. And that could bring in quite a lot of revenue if everyone was charged 6 pence a mile. Of course, I think it will also put off a lot of people with the high price of EV cars in the marketplace from buying the EV car. So it's a fine balancing act to get the marketing side right and to get the taxation policy right and, of course, to make it equitable across the piece. But it's a conundrum. I think I need to go and have a look and see what's happening elsewhere in the world with regard to EV taxation. And perhaps we'll return to this in a future episode of the Chain Reaction podcast when I've done my homework. Now, this week I was busy writing for my new book, which will be out next year, and finishing off some pieces for the new edition. And one of them was a case study just a short case study about IKEA and the sort of things that they're doing in the supply chain. And while I was doing my research for the particular story, I noticed that IKEA's investment arm, Inca Investments, has acquired a software company made for Net. There's no disclosure on the purchase price that they've paid, but their technology is going to be used across stores to update fulfillment and omni-channel operations. And IKEA hopes to speed up deliveries, accurately fulfill orders, and it will help their transformation program in managing the supply chain. And that was all put together in a press release from the company. It's all been part of the total effort over the past few years to integrate and transform their supply chain. Back in April, they announced a $2.2 billion omni-channel growth strategy, and they really want to get the fulfillment part of the business right. And they don't do things in halves at IKEA. They seem to work quite hard to get these things organized. And they realize the trend in the marketplace is to, I suppose, click and collect with a lot of purchases these days. So they're going to have 900 pickup locations. It's called the Nine Plan. And it hopes this will help its businesses compete with the home decor rivals, such as Wayfair. They've struggled for quite a few years to actually integrate store and warehouse inventories. And it's a difficult transition for many retailers getting in that match between the warehouse operation, the online business, and what's in the retail store. And some big retailers solve that problem because they make their stores operate like warehouses too. If you think about home deliveries and groceries, that's how they run them in many of the big retail organizations. They run the retail store as a warehouse for home delivery, as well as a retail store for customers dropping in. So I'll be following this one with interest, and I'll be putting some updates on my blog site later in the year, which will supplement some of the content that's in the book. So while I'm mentioning the book, I suppose anybody that's studying supply chains might want to get hold of that book when it's out next year sometime. I'll update people with dates as I get the news. Now, I also came across a good story this week from Alessandra Salgado, who's an associate editor at Supply Chain Dive. And she wrote a piece about logistic providers bet on tech to improve warehouse efficiency. If you've not read it, I suggest you get across there and have a read. And she talks about companies like Maersk, DHL and Seco Logistics, all piloting new technologies over the past year. And then she provides 10 stories that tell how. And they're interesting. It's about robotics and for FedEx Express, DHL supply chain, Locus Robotics, plan to deploy 5K robots worldwide, Amazon opening robotic fulfillment centers in Connecticut, and Maersk testing new warehouse automation solutions, JD.com, self-operating warehouses. That sounds good, doesn't it? Self-operating warehouses. I'm laughing, but of course you can see the reality could be there, couldn't it, really? I've been in warehouses where there are no people and things move around automatically, so you can see that that's quite desirable. And anyway, if you've got some time, pop across to Supply Chain Dive and take a look at that. It's a great story. I always think warehouses don't get enough attention, and I thought that in examining supply chains when we look at the problems of inventory, if you can get your warehouse sorted out and you can get goods moving through that space, you don't need warehouses that are quite as big. Even if you're trying to build resilient supply chains, you can still, with smart technology, lower the space that you need. So, having written my chapters on supply chain technology in the past few weeks for my new book, I'm all up to date right now with the latest smart technology. Well, if you haven't stopped by to pick up the special edition on artificial intelligence just yet and how that's used in supply chains, you might want to do that in the next week or so. Get along and have a listen. And we've got some other editions which are due out shortly. Last Mile Logistics is out in the next week or two. And Future Jobs and the Skills Needed. That's a good one for anybody looking for a new job in supply chains or entering the supply chain area. So get along and pick those up. And there's plenty of other episodes for you to listen to. So drop by the site and pick them up and have a listen. Well, that's it for this week's news round. I hope you've learned something you didn't know before. I'm Tony Hines. I'm signing off. And I'll see you next time. Bye for now. The Chain Reaction Podcast is written, presented and produced by Tony Hines. Hi, I'm Tony Hines. I'm here to tell you about the Chain Reaction Podcast, all about supply chain advantage. I've been researching and writing about supply chains for over 25 years. I wrote my first book on supply chain strategies in the early 2000s. Each week we have special episodes on particular topics relating to supply chains, and we have a weekly news roundup every Saturday at 12 noon, all things impacting global supply chains in that week. So come and join us on the Chain Reaction Podcast. I look forward to seeing you there. I'm Tony Hines. I'm signing off. Bye for now.